We're going to talk about the frailty chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook, www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayette. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. Our mission today in this deep dive is really to pull out those crucial, actionable insights from that specific frailty chapter. We want to give you a genuinely nuanced understanding of this really complex state, something to equip you with knowledge that will, powerfully inform how you practice later, whether that's in musculoskeletal medicine or, frankly, any field.
Absolutely. And that nuanced understanding, it's becoming, it's not just important anymore. It's vital. Frailty isn't some niche topic. Its relevance is just exploding, especially as the global population gets older. Getting a real handle on frailty isn't just for the orthopods or geriatricians. It's critical for all medical professionals because fundamentally it affects risk and recovery pretty much across the board, whatever patients you see.
Okay, so to really get this, we need to start at the beginning, lay the foundation. What exactly is frailty, like at its medical core? The chapter paints a picture of it as this state of vulnerability, linked intrinsically to aging, yes, but also a general physiological decline and, this seems key, depleted bodily reserves.
That's right.
And what that means clinically, it says, is impaired homeostasis. The body's ability to keep things stable inside.
Right, that internal balance.
So if something relatively minor happens, maybe a simple fall or even just a standard operation, a frail patient faces this disproportionately high risk. We're talking disability, long hospital stays.
Even the increased mortality, it throws that balance way off.
So when you frame it like that, it becomes clear pretty quickly that frailty, even if we first think of it in terms of bones and muscles.
Yeah, like osteoporosis or sarcopenia.
Right. The bone density loss, the muscle wasting, weakness, can't exercise like they used to.
But it's so much more than just that. It really is a whole person concept. This vulnerability, it stretches across declining endocrine function, neurological, cardiovascular, immune systems. Even psychological function plays a huge role.
So it's like a systemic unraveling. Almost.
That's a good way to put it. The body's overall ability to bounce back, its resilience, is just severely compromised.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit then to the wider picture. The epidemiology. These numbers are, they're quite staggering, actually. It's directly tied to this global aging trend. Think about this. Back in 2004, about 461 million people over 65 worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
By 2025, which is basically tomorrow, medically speaking, that number is projected to hit maybe 2 billion.
2 billion. It's incredible. And the fastest growth is in the oldest group, the over 80s.
Just let that sink in. I mean, that's not just a small shift. It fundamentally changes what normal patient care is going to look like. It demands we start thinking about frailty assessment almost routinely, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Proactively. And the prevalence data supports that urgency. It goes from maybe 4% in the 65 to 69 group.
Okay, relatively low there.
Up to 26% over a quarter for those over 85. That's a huge jump.
Wow. And you also mentioned it's more common in biological females. Why is that?
Well, there are a few factors. Typically, females start with less bone and muscle mass on average. Plus, they generally live longer. If you look at the U.S., for instance, something like 75% of people over 90 are female, so they're more represented in the age groups where frailty is most common.
Okay, that makes sense. So connecting this back to the clinic, it's important, you're saying, to distinguish frailty from just having diseases or disabilities.
Yes, critically important. They're definitely related. They overlap, no question. Advanced age, lots of comorbidities, existing disabilities, these all increase the risk of frailty. But, and this is the key, frailty can and often does exist independently. So as clinicians, we need to keep a high index of suspicion. We need to be vigilant for it in all older patients, not just the ones with a long problem list.
Because the defining thing is that physiological decline, that lack of reserve.
Exactly. That's the hallmark. It means frail patients can have really profound, lasting negative effects from stressors. Stressors that healthier, non-frail people would probably shrug off with minimal trouble.
And structurally, that often looks like the osteoporosis and sarcopenia we mentioned.
Right. And functionally, that translates to poor balance, weakness, lower endurance, which of course ramps up the fall risk dramatically.
Falls are a huge issue.
Huge. And we can't overlook the psychosocial side either. Things like depression, being socially isolated, even poverty, these things chip away at a patient's resilience too, making them more vulnerable.
It's truly multifaceted. And as we're digging into all these crucial facets of frailty, This feels like a good moment just to remind everyone listening.
Yeah.
All this great information we're exploring comes straight from the frailty chapter of orthopedia.com. Remember, that's the fantastic, free, peer-reviewed resource. We're hitting the highlights here, giving you the essentials. But really, for that complete picture, especially before you treat a patient, you've got to read the book itself. It's indispensable.
Okay,
so we've established what frailty is, its scale, its complexity. The next big question has to be, how do we actually identify it in our patients?
Yeah.
Beyond just, you know, an experienced guess, what are the main models the chapter lays out for diagnosis?
Right, the how do we spot it question. The chapter details two primary models. First up is the frail phenotype model.
Okay. Phenotype.
Yeah, this is a clinical assessment. It looks for whether a patient has 3 or more out of 5 specific observable signs, things like, did they lose weight unintentionally? Do they report feeling exhausted all the time? Is their energy expenditure low? Are they walking slowly? Do they have measurable weakness, like poor grip strength?
So concrete things you can see or ask about.
Exactly. 3 or more, they meet the criteria for frail. If they have just 1 or 2, they're considered pre-frail. It's practical, kind of like a checklist approach.
Okay, that seems pretty straightforward, looking for those physical signs.
Yeah.
But then you mentioned a second model, the frailty index. Hmm. How does that differ? What does it add?
The frailty index offers maybe a more nuanced view. Instead of just frail, not frail, it sees frailty as this quantifiable thing. It reflects a sort of cumulative decline across lots of different body systems.
Quantifiable, okay. How does it measure that?
It uses a large number of variables, could be 30, could be 70 or more, covering different aspects of health. Think symptoms the patient reports, functional deficits you observe, chronic diseases they have, even abnormal lab results. Each variable is just scored as present or absent. And the index is calculated basically as the proportion of these deficits that are present.
Okay, so like a percentage.
Exactly. So if you have, say, an index with 80 possible deficits and the patient has 20 of them present, their index is 20 out of 80, which is 25%. Then you might have a threshold, maybe 20% or 25%, where above that score, the patient is considered frail.
Ah, I see. So it's not just yes, no. It gives you a degree.
Precisely. It measures the severity of frailty. And that's incredibly valuable because you can track changes over time.
Yeah.
Is the patient getting more frail? Are interventions helping? The index gives you a way to measure that.
It sounds powerful for monitoring.
Yeah.
Now, beyond these clinical models, what about objective evidence? Especially thinking about the musculoskeletal side again. How does imaging fit in?
Imaging is crucial here. For bone health, assessing bone mineral density, looking for osteopenia or osteoporosis, the gold standard is the DXA scan, dual energy X-ray absorptiometry.
Right, DXA for bones. What about muscle for sarcopenia?
Well, you often suspect sarcopenia based on clinical assessment, like checking muscle strength. But imaging, typically CT or MRI scans, can really confirm it and quantify the muscle loss. And the chapter highlights something quite specific and interesting. Using abdominal CT scans.
Abdominal CT, how does that relate?
They've found that looking at the cross-sectional area of the psoas major muscle, specifically at the L4, L5 disc level, a decreased area there correlates strongly with an increased need for dependent living support later on.
Wow. So measuring that muscle on a scan can actually predict functional decline and need for care.
Yeah, it's not just about muscle size and isolation. It's using an objective imaging marker to get a window into potential future functional implications, which can really guide how you plan care.
That's fascinating. Okay, this leads us right into management, particularly in acute situations like trauma. The stakes there are so high for frail patients. What are the absolute paramount precautions, and how does knowing someone is frail change how we act immediately?
You've had a critical point. We know, the data is clear, higher frailty scores predict more in-hospital complications, greater chance of needing more care upon discharge, and sadly, higher mortality. But, and this is important, really conscientious, frailty-informed care can limit these risks significantly.
So what does that look like in practice, say in the ER with a trauma patient?
Okay, well, meticulous fluid management is huge. Frail patients walk a tightrope. They need adequate resuscitation, but they tolerate volume overload very poorly. So careful monitoring is key.
Right. Avoiding fluid overload. What else?
Pain management needs to be very careful, often using lower doses, maybe different types of agents, to avoid side effects like respiratory depression or delirium, which they're much more susceptible to. And because their physiological reserves are so low after an injury, sometimes the best approach is damage control orthopedics.
Damage control orthopedics. Explain that.
It means you limit the initial surgery to just simple stabilization, maybe external fixation. You don't go for the big definitive repair right away. The goal is to let the patient recover somewhat from the initial physiological shock of the trauma first.
Before attempting the major surgery.
Exactly. Trying to do too much, too soon, complex, lengthy surgery up front massively increases risks like hypothermia, acidosis,
A
coagulopathy.
lethal triad.
Precisely. And ARDS, multiple organ dysfunction, it can spiral quickly. So damage control buys time and reduces that initial hit. It's also worth remembering that for some very frail patients, non-operative management might actually be the best path if it achieves reasonable goals without the risks of surgery.
So sometimes less is more.
Sometimes less is definitely more. And beyond individual care, there are systemic things helping now too, like geriatric emergency departments. These are set up specifically to apply gerontology principles right in the ED, managing not just the trauma, but also common comorbidities like dementia, delirium, malnutrition. It's a collaborative, specialized approach.
That sounds like a really positive development. Okay, so we understand the risks and the need for tailored acute care. What about proactively mitigating these risks, improving outcomes long term?
Well, the biggest risk factor for frailty is simply aging. We can't stop that. And frailty itself then becomes a huge risk factor for poor outcomes after any major stressor, like trauma or surgery. Now, while we don't have definitive evidence yet on how to truly reverse frailty,
Right, no magic bullet yet.
not yet, but there are many proposed steps that seem to improve quality of life and build resilience, and they carry very little risk themselves. For sarcopenia and weight loss, things like structured exercise programs focusing on strength, balance are key, plus nutritional support, especially making sure they get enough protein.
Exercise and nutrition makes sense. What else?
Tackling polypharmacy is vital. That's when patients are on multiple medications, often too many. Reducing unnecessary meds minimizes the risk of side effects and interactions, which frail patients are very prone to.
Good point. Easy to overlook.
And something else, seemingly simple but critical, assessing for vision and hearing problems. These sensory deficits don't just increase fall risk directly, they can also lead to social isolation, which further reduces resilience.
Ah, so it all connects. Exercise, nutrition, meds, senses.
Yeah.
That's quite holistic when you list it out.
It really is. It's about building that resilience buffer from multiple angles.
That leads perfectly into something you touched on, this idea of prehab. Can you elaborate on that? What is prehabilitation, and why is it becoming so important before surgery in frail individuals?
Absolutely. Look, surgery is a massive physiological stress. For frail patients, it's inherently risky, often leads to complications. So the strategies often boil down to, can we avoid surgery by adjusting the goals? Or if surgery is necessary, can we delay it slightly to optimize the patient first? Prehab is that optimization process. It's a structured approach to build up the patient's reserves before they face the stress of the operation.
So what does prehab typically involve?
It's usually multimodal. There's exercise training, tailored programs to boost cardiovascular endurance, muscle strength, balance, really targeting those physical deficits. There's nutritional optimization, maybe dietary counseling, protein supplements, ensuring they have the metabolic building blocks for recovery. Psychological support can be part of it too. Lifestyle changes like quitting smoking, cutting back on alcohol, and just generally fine-tuning their overall medical status, getting chronic conditions as stable as possible before they head to the OR.
So it's like training for the marathon of surgery and recovery.
That's a great analogy. You're proactively building their physiological buffer, their resilience, so they can better withstand the hit and bounce back afterwards.
Okay, fantastic. Now, to really cement all this in our minds, let's quickly recap. Let's crystallize this deep dive around, say, five essential terms that capture the core ideas.
Good idea. These are like mental anchors. First, frail phenotype. Remember, these are those observable physical signs: weight loss, exhaustion, slow walking, weakness, low activity. Three or more point to frailty in this model.
Got it. Observable characteristics.
Second, the frailty index. This is that quantitative score. It measures the accumulation of deficits across many body systems, giving a degree or severity of frailty, not just yes, no.
Right, the cumulative score.
Third, sarcopenia. That's the age-related loss of muscle mass and function, a key component of musculoskeletal frailty, leading directly to weakness and reduced endurance.
Muscle loss.
Key part. Fourth, damage control orthopedics. That crucial trauma strategy for frail patients. Initial, simpler stabilization first, allowing physiological recovery before the big definitive surgery, reducing immediate risks.
Stabilize first, definitive later.
And finally, number five, prehab. Prehabilitation, that proactive, multi-pronged approach exercise, nutrition, medical optimization before surgery or another stressor, aimed at boosting resilience and improving outcomes.
Build them up beforehand. Perfect. This has been incredibly illuminating, really shedding light on a condition that, as you said, is just going to become more and more central to patient care everywhere. We have just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia. Orthopedia by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayet. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. You'll be glad you did.